Well, welcome to the abbreviated After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. It's still going to be a very good show because I have, to begin with, two of my favorite people on the planet and two of the most talented people I've ever known in the world of journalism. They are on because Tuesday night at the Museum of Broadcast Communications, which is at the corner of Kinsey and State, there is an event. Get there at 6. It is titled Surviving R. Kelly to the Reckoning. It is a conversation based on the second edition of the R. Kelly horror story that Lifetime has made. On the phone with me now, and thanks for staying up, is Jim DeRogatis, whose 2019 book, Soulless, A Case Against R. Kelly, is one of the great books of that year or any year. It's a marvel of great reporting, diligent reporting, and it is a driving narrative. He will be at the museum. The museum is run by my old friend Susie Schultz. She's the executive director. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thanks, Rick.
Jim, you know what I think of this book. I have seen both editions of this Surviving R. Kelly 1 and 2. Two is filled, I don't want you to give away too much of what you're going to talk about Tuesday, two is filled with nothing but, to my mind, nothing but horrors and the tears of broken women. Is that a pretty good assessment, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, there are some very powerful voices that come forward that didn't talk the first time. Tiffany Hawkins, who I call after Randy Schultz of the band played on, yep. Patient Zero.
Yeah.
You know, she was the first girl who tried to stop him with a lawsuit in 1996 for sexual contact that began when she was 15 in 1991. You know, and Dominique Gardner, one of the last who kind of broke away from him after 9 years. And, you know, those are voices that weren't in the first, but I think there's also a lot of reflection.
No question. Yeah.
You know, and some patting themselves on the back. You know, Lifetime, Bonham Murray Television, but television helped bring this to an end. The television couldn't have happened without the journalism.
That,
you know,
is a fact.
But still, the power of hearing these women tell their stories as you sit in your living room in front of this screen. You know, it's we are in this weird, surreal reality TV time, and for once, reality television seems to be leading to justice.
Susie, did you see it yet? Have you seen it?
Yes, I've seen both parts.
And what's your take?
I mean, powerful is an understatement.
Yeah.
I think, and I actually think it's very difficult to watch. Very difficult to watch, especially this last one, because these women who did put so much on the line to tell their stories, how they have actually paid a dear price. So many people have accused them of getting money out of this and being gold diggers for all this, and in reality, they've endured threats. They have been name called. They have really put themselves out there for justice.
Yeah.
And yet still, it's interesting. It's not everybody in any way, shape, or form, but there's a segment of society that still sticks by this predator and still sticks by this man as somebody who has to be held up for as an artist and for the work that he's done. And I think, you know, no matter what we say about the program tonight, Rick, we're not going to give away anything on Tuesday, because Tuesday is really a chance for, you know, that what the museum wants to be is not just this stagnant place where you can look at things.
Exactly.
But we want people to be able to have access and to have the opportunity to interact with people like Jim.
Yeah.
And Mary Mitchell, who is an award-winning columnist and editorial writer. She at the Sun-Times. She wrote about this as well for years, giving a perspective on the Black community's response to all of this. And
Maudlin, too, is going to moderate.
Yeah, Maudlin Ujerica will be moderating the discussion. And what we want to do is give people access to be able to discuss this, because it was such a difficult thing to watch. It's one of those things where, you know, when you know, it used to be we'd have these water cooler discussions after something that aired.
Yeah.
We'd all go and talk about it, right?
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen because the broadcast medium is actually so huge in many ways. So we don't know who watched what or who did what. So we're doing like a call out to the people who did watch this and want to have a chance to talk about it, to understand it more, to talk to Jim and to talk to Mary, who reported on this forever, who know this story, and really figure out what their questions are.
Well, and where, you know, and where we go from here, too. I think one of the important things that is a leitmotif in your book, Jim, and I'm looking now, I could look on almost any page, but one of the sentences that really, really gets to me is one beginning near chapter 6, where you write, "Conversations with many black colleagues made me think that if Kelly's alleged victims hadn't been black, the story would have gotten much more coverage." I believe in this case that racism plays such an important role, and such an important role in other media, not Jim DeRogatis and Abdon Palish and Mary Mitchell of the Sun-Times for almost two decades. But that seems to me to be a very, very ugly subtext of this whole thing. Do you agree? Or remind me?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Rick. You know, I mean, you and I and Susie, we love this city.
Yep.
But if there's one thing we hate about it, it is the racism and the divide between white Chicago and black Chicago, brown Chicago. You know, I understand to some degree these people who are defending Kelly, even with 30 years of overwhelming evidence laid bare, because so many black heroes are torn down.
Yep.
You know, I get that. But you know, what I never have understood is his defenders, and they are legion. And, you know, I've gotten a measure of the hatred directed against these women, which is overwhelming, you know, to them.
Yep.
But just seeing some of it, you know, I mean, I'm apparently in the KKK, and right. I'm a champion of black gen. I mean, the stuff that, you know, you wake up in the morning, you turn on your phone,
yep.
and, you know, you get hit with a dozen of these tweets. They're absurd, and they're violent, and they're, but I kind of understand, you know, race in this country is so messed up that people are defending, but it's inexcusable, because even these haters, men and women, they have sisters, they have daughters, they
exactly.
have cousins, they have aunties
exactly.
who could have been this man's victims, in some cases were
yeah.
this man's victims.
I know, it just boggles my mind. We got to take a short break. I'm on the phone with Jim DeRogatis, who is the author of Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly, one of the most majestic pieces of journalism and narrative writing that I have ever found between the cover of a book. He will be at the Museum of Broadcast Communication Tuesday night, starting at 6, a conversation 6 to 8 with Mary Mitchell. Susie Schultz is also on the phone. She runs the place, and I'm assuming, Susie, it was your idea. Welcome back. In his book, Soulless, The Case Against R. Kelly, which should be on the bookshelves of everyone in this city for a variety of reasons, critic, teacher, author Jim DeRogatis writes, quoting his great role model critic Lester Bangs, he writes, "Rock and roll comes down to myth. There are no facts." Then he writes, "From the beginning, R. Kelly excelled at building the myth. The myth has come shattering down, thanks in great and large part to the work of Jim at the Sun-Times, along with his colleague Abdon Palish and the columnist there, Mary Mitchell." Jim and Mary Mitchell will be at the Museum of Broadcast Communications Tuesday night. To get tickets, just go to museumtv.com, right? You know me,
it's
Susie.
Museum, it's museum.tv.
Okay, well, you know me. I don't know anything about the internet. Susie, was this... I mean, the Museum of Broadcast Communications has long been an interesting and sort of entertaining and occasionally playful place to be. This is a very... It's had some serious events and topics. Was this idea yours to bring Jim and Mary together?
Yeah, well, it just seemed a natural thing.
Yeah.
I mean, when they announced the second part of Surviving R. Kelly, which was going to, they announced this late in December that it was going to air, the second, third, and fourth of January. And I thought the conversations around the the first documentary series were just huge. They really changed a lot of people's minds. But also got people very angry and upset. And I think that the museum at this juncture doesn't want to shy away from any difficult conversation.
No, I'm really pleased. I mean, it's a great place to visit, and I love seeing, you know, Howdy Doody there, if you still have Howdy Doody there. but I think these kinds of programs, and I'm not sure there's going to be one more powerful than this in the near future, especially with Jim talking. Is it sold out?
It's not sold out yet. There are some tickets available. I think that, I think it's a difficult conversation. And one of the things that that we want people to know for sure is that this is a program. This is one of the things we want to give to the community.
Yeah.
This is a program. We're charging for this, but we are only charging because we need to pay the staff that stays after hours to keep the place open.
Of course.
This is not how we're going to be making money.
No, with a limit of 60 tickets. And also, you have to tell me that you're going to have copies of Jim's book available for sale there.
Yes, we are. Yes, good. We are. Yes.
Jim, I know one of the worst people in your book, and it comes out in the second part of the R. Kelly documentary, too, is Susan Loggins, who is a lawyer who made a ton of deals that enabled maybe a dozen people who were abused by R. Kelly to get money and never tell their stories. These non-disclosure agreements are frightening to me. But she...
Yeah, they're the theme of Ronan Farrow and Megan Toohey and Jody Cantor's two books on Harvey Weinstein.
Yep.
I was on a panel in Philadelphia with Megan Toohey, who's an Evanston native. And she was saying, we discovered this new method of revealing the stories of Weinstein by going after the NDAs. And I was like, no. Abden and I were doing that in November 2000. This is a problem in American justice, the civil courts, allowing these documents, to silence people who have been wronged, especially women. Mm-hmm. You know, imagine if the mob could just buy their way out of all their crimes by paying people off.
Sure.
They try, but that doesn't hold up in criminal court. Mm-hmm. NDAs frighten women from telling the truth. You know, Loggins came to the attention of the first girl who sued Kelly, Tiffany Hawkins, because of her TV commercials.
I know.
And because she had a radio show.
She didn't know who else to call. Yeah.
She avoided this documentary. She talked to me for the book.
Right.
And she says, you know, hey, criminal justice does not get these women anywhere. The only recompense they have is to make people pay. Now, that's the same thing Gloria Allred says.
I think
there needs to be a lot of examination, especially on these would-be crusading feminists who are using this tool essentially to get rich, not
exactly.
to get justice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But, I'd love to see...
around is something that we want to make sure we continually discuss at the museum, which is the power of television, the power of radio.
Yep.
I mean, where did they find her? They found her on television and radio. And where is celebrity lying? When we have an exhibit right now that talks about rock and roll and television, and how rock and roll, which was, you know, both are art forms that came about in the 40s, but by the 50s, television is looking around with 17 million viewers going, oh my God, we're going to need these young people, and these young people like this music.
Yeah.
So they elevated this music to another level, another whole level. The way we see celebrity has changed because of television. So what are the ramifications of that?
Well, I mean, again,
celebrity another reason why he was able to get away with it.
Well, I hope someone brings up Michael Avenatti, who appears at the beginning of this second installment of the R. Kelly thing, too. It just, what I found among the most moving things, and I don't want to give away too much to people. I'm not giving away too much to people who haven't seen it, but
you're not.
The woman at the end, the woman named Lanita Carter, who was hired to braid R. Kelly's hair. She says in the show that how warm, welcoming, and inviting he was. And then as she starts to crumble, and I'm not sure, Jim, you would know, I'm not sure she suffered sexual abuse at his hands, but in the whole scheme of things, she then says, with tears pouring down her face, that he crushed her life.
Yeah, I mean, her story is similar to so many of them.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they were aspiring singers, aspiring artists, just people trying to make a living, who had the life force sucked out of them by these encounters.
By his ability to sort of elevate them in their own kind of sphere, that her doing R. Kelly's, braiding R. Kelly's hair made her a kind of, you know, semi-hero in her own family. The show was something I reread after watching it last week and somehow on a computer. I even know how to work at TV, and rereading your book, I was chilled again to the bone, Jim. And the fact, turning to that first page where you dedicate your remarkable book, Soulless, A Case Against R. Kelly, for the girls.
Well, you know, Rick, all we are supposed to do as journalists is be a megaphone to amplify those who are not being heard in society.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, the heroes of stopping Kelly are the women who have come forward.
Yeah.
And in many cases, you know, they came forward years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Linita Carter,
yeah.
Tiffany Hawkins, they tried to get action from the state's attorney, you know. And then again, the power of television. Kim Fox, a year ago, sees that this the original six-part series,
right,
garners 26 million viewers, mm-hmm, and holds a press conference and says, you know, women come forward. Well, two of them already had.
Right.
Geronda Pace had come forward and been ignored. Linita Carter had come forward and been ignored. You know,
I want to go back to the idea that one of the things that is bone-chilling is when a lot of these women are interviewed, and indeed R. Kelly's brothers are interviewed,
yep,
what we find at the basis of many of their experiences is sexual assault at a young age.
Oh, yeah.
And I think what societally we don't recognize, because it's just too difficult to talk about, is how good predators are at what they do.
We don't give them enough credit for
being good.
Yeah, they are hunting.
At finding, yes.
It shows how R. Kelly was a hunter of great talent, excuse the word, for finding the most vulnerable people in places where so many people are vulnerable. It's like hunting the weakest.
But
the weakest.
He and his family were also victims.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that victims, as Jim has well said in the documentary, that victims go on to prey on people.
Yep.
That is not necessarily the case at all. But what struck me was all these stories of people who, beyond their R. Kelly experience, had been fell prey to,
yep,
other sexual assault.
Yep.
And so
we should point out
is how rampant this is.
We should point out, Susie, that there's some extraordinary groups in Chicago. Resilience is one of them, and Lifespan is another.
Right.
Who are available to women.
Can I say, Jim, I don't think you know this, but Resilience is actually going to have a table at the event for anybody who is there.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, Lifespan, which fights domestic and sexual violence in this city, a lot of the best attorneys in the city give time pro bono. And Resilience is women who sit and do this incredible thing of guiding a woman through filing her criminal charges and the rape kit and all of this. You know, I mean, there are people in this city who are working on this problem and who care. So if any good comes out of the tragedy of these 30 years of R. Kelly's predatory behavior, it's that it has grabbed the spotlight and people are not feeling alone, and they're feeling empowered to talk about it. And organizations that are out there doing the work are getting some attention. You know, I mean, maybe the conversation is starting. Because as Mary Mitchell always wrote from the beginning, as she was doing columns besides our reporting, you know, all of the girls who are getting pregnant in CPS underage are not having sex with boys their age.
Yeah, I know.
There are a lot of them where there are older men in the community preying on younger women and really ruining their lives. Because
yeah,
when
forever.
You're 15 and 16 in high school getting pregnant, you're getting derailed.
It is an essential conversation to have, and it continues. Tuesday night, 6 o'clock, the Museum of Broadcast Communications, right at the corner of Kinsey and State Street. Go to museum.tv to get tickets. You can buy Jim's book there. You should read Jim's book, whether you can go to the event or not. Susie Schultz is the executive director of that museum. Jim DeRogatis is the author of many things, the host of co-host of Sound Opinions with Greg Kot, and the author of...
And a great reporter.
And, well, all you need do, ladies and gentlemen, is pick up and read Soulless, A Case Against R. Kelly. Jim has done other reporting in other places, but this is just a definitive, remarkable book. You know how much I admire both of you. Thank you for staying up late.
Thank you, Rick.
Anytime. I'll see you Tuesday. We've got to take a little break for news or non-news or a commercial or whatever we're doing on the great WGN. And we'll be back to talk about alcoholism. Hey, what a way to start the Welcome back. When I think I got an email or a call from an old friend of mine. I'm not sure we were really ever great friends, but we certainly knew each other, a guy named Jeffrey Pone, who said, Rick, how are you? I said, Jeff, what have you been up to for the last 30 or so years? He told me what he'd been up to, and then that he had just written a book. And I must tell you something. I've been around and associated with alcohol and alcoholics and alcoholism from my own childhood, and certainly getting in the newspaper business where there are many people who fall prey to the bottle. Jeff Pone, welcome to the show. I was really kind of overwhelmed by your book. Do you take that kindly, or what do you think about that? Overwhelmed? Is that what you were looking for in a reader?
That's perfect. That's great.
I'm going
to read. Because it was an overwhelming experience for me to live.
Well, I'll bet, man. I'll bet.
Yeah.
I want to start. I want to read. The preface is different, and we'll get to that. But here is the beginning of Jeffrey Pone's, that's P-O-H-N, Blotto, B-L-O-T-T-O, Adventures in Alcoholism, Rune to Recovery. Here, Jeff, you do a remarkable way of capturing Rune. My days are devoted to the killing of cockroaches who are sharing my scuzzy single apartment in Hollywood. I'm drinking around the clock, but to diminishing returns. I have to drink more and more to achieve the desired effect. Blotto. I buy my booze at different liquor stores, and the guys behind the counter don't recognize me as a drunk. My body wakes me up in the middle of the night demanding alcohol. I sleep with a cheap bottle of vodka under my bed, and I am gifted tiny vials of cocaine from the sweetheart of a dealer who knows I can no longer afford to pay. Skipping down a paragraph, you say, I'm not a bad guy. I'm well-educated. I love my mother. I floss semi-regularly. So how did I wind up like this at 30 years old? Allow me to take you back to where it all began as I remember it. Your memory is pretty good, but you do in the preface, and I want to read a bit of that too, Jeffrey.
Sure.
Mention that you can't always trust your memory, can you? Because
no.
Brain cells have been diminished.
Yes.
Elaborate.
Oh, well, in writing this, when I finally sat down to write it, I began to explore my past, and I had all kinds of memories and a tremendous amount of fuzziness because, as you just mentioned, I had destroyed a number of brain cells.
Sure.
And it was fascinating to me because I wound up getting in touch with all kinds of people who had shared those years with me, from sisters to an aunt to friends. And I told them what I remembered, and they, almost to a man or to a person,
a woman,
said to me, no, no, that's not what happened. This is what happened.
Wow.
So, you know, I had my own collection of memories, many of which were solid, you know, absolutely solid, and others that simply weren't, because I had whole decades that were fuzzy.
Sure.
And so I started to patch together this collection of experiences and memories.
What's it?
And as I did, more and more bubbled up. Stuff that I hadn't thought about in years. Just started bubbling up. And I just tried to get, for the longest time, I just got the stuff down. I just reported it.
Yeah.
And only after quite a while did I start to, you know, attempt to form it, to structure it and mold it.
Mm. One of your memories, your childhood memories, and this is a very, ladies and gentlemen, this is a very, very frank book, believe me, by Jeffrey Pohn. It deals with his parents, his relationships, somewhat tortured with his mother and father. Here, Jeff, on page 41 and 40 of Blotto, here is when Jeff had his first drink. He had just had his bar mitzvah, which he kind of faked his way through, frankly. Following the bar mitzvah, a fancy luncheon is held in my honor, as though nothing strange had just happened. I can't take it anymore. My head is about to explode. I steal a bottle of vodka from the open bar and dash into the men's room, where I duck into a stall, lock the doors, and pull my feet up so no one knows I'm there. I suck on the vodka bottle, my very first drink, and soon the warmth and wonderfulness spreads throughout my being. There you have captured, and I've heard this from other serious drinkers, that warmth and wonderfulness is for a time, Jeffrey, like a blanket that is protective, is it not?
Absolutely. In that moment, I had found the answer, nirvana.
Yeah.
I had spent the first 13 years of my life feeling quite uncomfortable in my skin, feeling wrong, feeling very out of place, even in my own family.
Sure.
And so I figured that feeling was going to just continue the rest of my life. And here, I'd seen adults drink. I'd seen them change and mellow out. And it was like an instinctive thing. I just reached for the bottle, took it in, drank it, and honestly, my life changed. And alcohol allowed me to do all kinds of things I could never do, like talk to girls.
Yeah.
It
emboldened. You know? There's no question. Yeah. I mean, that for many people is, and especially at that age, it's, unless you're, you know, falling down drunk, it's a very emboldening. It emboldens a person, and it emboldened you. It also, once you got in high school, the liquor led to some to drugs too, which often is the case.
Right, and I will tell you that if alcohol hadn't taken me down almost entirely, I would still be drinking today. Because it was wonderful, and I experienced that for many years, this wonderfulness that very slowly sort of turned and became anything but wonderful.
Well, you went out, Jeffrey is a local born and bred and has specific, one of the memories you didn't forget was living in an apartment which overlooked the Playboy Mansion when it was the Playboy Mansion, and and your ability with your buddies to sneak peeks at some of the ladies who live there sunbathing. That's probably a memory that couldn't be diminished no matter what.
No, it couldn't, and I relive it as much as possible. It was possibly the most wonderful moment of my childhood.
You were very frank and honest about your parents, and your dad drank, did he not?
Yes, he drank excessively, and he died, you know, he died from alcoholism at 43 years old.
Yeah. And part of the other thing, and I'm trying to get to, you know, how frank and honest this book is, after your father's death, when you were sort of not quite down and out in Hollywood, you kind of lived selling some of your father's things to get by, didn't you?
Yeah, you know, I wound up going to film school because I fell in love with movie making, and it was going quite well for a few years. I was, you know...
Let me read one thing toward that end. He writes here in chapter 25, and they're each very short chapters, like little short stories. He writes here, one steamy night in Chicago, Abe, who's a friend of yours, and I seek the cool of a movie theater where we see Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. Here's how honest you are. I am completely blown away and deeply impacted. Even though I have absolutely no knowledge of filmmaking, I become obsessed with the idea of making a takeoff on Taxi Driver, which I call Ice Cream Man. There is a lot of humor in this book, too, because I think because of your honesty and your story about how you go about trying to make Ice Cream Man is really something. But you do go to Hollywood and you get some lucky breaks and have a career there, right?
Yeah, I did have a career, and it right out of film school, I was enormously ambitious, and it really took off, and I was doing well, and the future looked bright, but I didn't realize what my alcohol consumption was going to do.
Yeah,
and it made me a bridge burner, a tantrum thrower, really a guy who people didn't want to work with.
Yeah.
And it fizzled you know, and by the time I was 30, there was virtually nothing going on in my life except drinking, and I wound up luckily getting sober.
Well, it is a book. It is the first half of it is very much a downward spiral, and the second half, which we'll get to after a short commercial break, is very much. I mean, you like AA. You were reluctant. You had some problems with the whole you know, higher power thing, and I want to talk about that. But it certainly did help you. There's a chapter that begins with your first AA meeting. I'll read from that after we take a short commercial break. I'm on the phone with Jeffrey Pohn. That's P-O-H-N. He is the author of Blotto, Adventures in Alcoholism, Rune to Recovery. I'm glad you're recovered, Jeff. You live in...
Thank you. Me too.
No kidding. We'll be right back.
All right.
Welcome back. We're talking with Jeffrey Pohn, who now lives a wonderfully sober life with... longtime wife, Posey, in Ojai, California. You still have a dog, Jeff?
Oh, yes.
What's the dog's name? Baby?
Yes, the dog's name is Baby.
When you met your wife after the age of 30, when you told her, the book was inspired by, I must say, the preface is really interesting, too. It's when your nephew Sammy comes out for a visit for spring break. He was had just turned 13, which is when you began to drink. And he started asking a bunch of questions. And that's really was a compelling factor to sit down and write this book, wasn't it?
Yes, it was very compelling. It was the catalyst. And it was so interesting because Sammy... lives in Chicago with the rest of my family, and every single adult he knew drank. I don't mean abusively.
Yeah,
drank.
Right.
His parents, his uncles, his aunts. I mean, they all did. So when he came to hang out with me, he couldn't believe that I didn't drink, and he was fascinated by it. I mean, he was so interested in it that we were watching Chicago Blackhawk game together.
Yeah.
And we had basically a Q&A that lasted over an hour. He actually turned the sound down on the Hawks game.
Oh, my God, that's serious.
Yeah. And I wound up sort of, I wouldn't say unburdening myself, but just talking. I felt safe with him. and I was hoping even to kind of steer him away from the road I had taken.
Wow.
And but after we had this one-hour conversation, I couldn't stop thinking. I was flooded with memories. It opened. It was like a Pandora's box. It opened, and I had to do something with them.
Well, I think what you've done is really remarkable. As I said, the first half of the book, it's only 200-some pages. It's a very quick read. The first half is the downward spiral, and the second half is the kind of upward spiral. But even there, Jeff Pohn, you're very, very honest. You write here... When I first got sober, I was afraid that life was going to be, and this is, man, this is so true of everybody I know who stopped drinking at one point. When I first got sober, I was afraid that life was going to be dull and boring, but a number of years into sobriety, it's anything but. I used to drink to take the edge off. Now there's only edge. It feels like a high wire act without a net or any kind of buffer. Life comes straight at me, and I no longer hide or flee. I take it on. I feel everything. I'm totally alive. I hardly ever experience the obsession to drink or use, but I have to stay vigilant. It's easy to forget that this is a life and death deal. I've attended too many funerals of sober friends who started drinking again. That's a great, that's really a great moving paragraph, Jeff.
Oh, thank you.
Now, did you, you must have during your raucous days, it's a wonder that you didn't alienate all of your family members, isn't it?
Or well, did, I did.
Okay. But alienate them to the point where they would never talk to you again or bring their nephew out to see you.
Well, it came by the time my nephew came out,
yeah.
I had been sober a number of years, and it had taken me so many years of just showing up in an undestructive way for my family to trust me again. I remember I took my first trip back to Chicago sober. I was about 4 months sober. I was expecting a hero's welcome, but I had forgotten that they had experienced me
as
for 30 years
as a monster, a tornado.
None of them would allow me to be alone with their children. And now I have incredible relationships with all my nephews and nieces. That's
fabulous.
Yes.
You decided to how much, you know, the thing about being in show business, which is a world that will foster and nurture insecurity and boost in spades, I suppose. How important was pulling out of that whole strange scene to your sobriety?
Well, I had really been in love with show business. Yeah. It's what I wanted to do. It's what I got to do.
Yeah.
It's what I started off, you know, like a house on fire. And later, particularly after I got sober, it was very difficult to exist in show business.
Yeah.
I was able.
It's all right.
Jerk. That I needed to be.
Doesn't have the same impact, but jerk
right.
will do, yeah.
In order to succeed in show business. And
yeah.
I could pull that off. It was natural. It was, you know, I did well in that vein. And, but later on, when I was trying to recover from alcohol, everything I was learning in terms of how I needed to live now, if I wanted to stay sober and wanted to stay alive, was contrary to most everything that was going on in show business. So I only pulled out probably, 5, 6, 7 years ago.
Yeah. What do you do now? What do you do now to make a living and be creatively satisfied?
Except writing this book. When I got out of show business and my wife sort of moved us to Ojai, which is a kind of idyllic place, it's a beautiful place, a friend of mine who's a very successful corporate headhunter kept trying to get me to work for him and with him, and I started doing that, and it was quite lucrative.
Oh, nice.
But I had zero interest in the world of business. I mean zero. And I did it. I made some money. And then maybe three, four years ago, I started feeling what I can only call a need to create,
nice.
To be creative.
Yeah.
I had to do something. I didn't know what it was going to be. I kept searching for things, not just writing, but painting or whatever. And
sure.
and it was during that experience that you and I just discussed with my nephew, that a light went on. And,
yeah.
and it was basically, you know, write this. And so now it's kind of a balanced life. I spent a good amount of time writing.
Right.
And I also, I don't work for this friend of mine anymore, the headhunter, but he calls me and I do searches for him. I find candidates
for
him.
Like freelance headhunter. Yeah.
Yeah. And it all works.
How often do you go to AA meetings?
Probably at this point, definitely once a week.
Oh, good for you.
usually twice. I've been sober for 33 years. It doesn't mean I don't need meetings. I desperately need them. I have to, and I can't let myself believe or think that I don't need them. And, you know, one of the things that really keeps me afloat is that all of my years of being sober in L.A. when I was going to AA, I wound up having a bunch of guys who I sponsored. They would call me.
Sure.
And
good for you.
All of them still call me. I don't see them.
Good for you. Well, yeah, that whole sponsor thing, you know, I know AA, never having been a member, but I certainly know a lot of members. That sponsorship thing is a crucially important role, and it says something really good about you, Jeffrey Pone, that so many people have chosen you as their sponsor. How often do you get back to Chicago, Jeff?
Well, you know, I have three sisters still there and all of my nephews, and I really, I'll tell you how much I love Chicago. I have been in Los Angeles for 40 years.
Yeah.
And I have never been, I've tried, but I've never been able to become a Lakers fan, a Rams fan, a Dodgers fan. I can't do it. And I still root and, in fact, watch every single Bears-Hawks-Bulls game.
That's great. You still have a lot. You have friends in Chicago from your high school days, too?
Oh, yeah. I've got a bunch of friends in Chicago from my high school days.
Well, come back for a reunion, because I'd love to see you face. It's been a long time since I've seen you face-to-face. I'd like to see you.
It was 40 years ago.
Yeah, and you were still, and you weren't healthy then. I'd like to see the healthy Jeff Pone. I think that would be a great thing.
Next time I come back, and I do get back, whenever possible, I will look you up, and you can see the healthy face.
Where can people buy this book? I'm assuming Amazon.com?
Yeah, Amazon.com. You simply have to go, just type in Blotto.
Sure. Yeah, it's a good title,
on,
too.
Thank you very much.
TTO.
Yeah.
The author's
and it's a
name is
I'm
Jeffrey.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Jeffrey, last name Pone, P-O-H-N. And it is, I've read, ladies and gentlemen listening, I think I've read enough short excerpts from it to intrigue you. One last question, Jeff. When you when you told your wife, your longtime wife, that you were writing this book, I'm sure she said, "Well, that's good, honey. I can't wait to read it." What did she think when she read it?
Well, she cried.
Yeah,
and she loved it, and she was touched by it. And by the way, I, you know, made a real point of having her character come off extremely well.
No question. good thinking, Jeff. Good thinking.
She was very proud, and she was very moved, and she couldn't have been more supportive the whole time.
That's good. Was she a little horrified too? Did she? Because some
yes.
of it, yeah, I'll bet.
Absolutely.
I'll bet.
There were so many things in that book. That she didn't know, that I had never told her. It's, you know,
well, for good reason in most cases.
She never would have married me.
Yeah, you know? No kidding, Jeff. It's really great to talk to you after so many years, and it was a jarring pleasure to read your book. Again, the first half of Blotto was about Jeff Pone's falling into a bottle. And the second half is a real kind of hopeful story of his ability to crawl out and to thrive. So, Jeff, Happy New Year, pal.
Thank you, Rick. Same to you. And thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, no,
this
see you when you come
pleasure.
In. Give me a call when you're coming in.
Will do.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. Take care.
Roe Coleman, the world's greatest producer, and your friend there, he didn't fall asleep. This is really good. He's a Rick Hogan fan now. Happy New Year, honey. And to you, sir. Dan Long, Happy New Year. We carry on. And to all of you, thanks for listening. We have a full show, one of those rare full shows next week, so I will book it with some interesting guests. Have a good week. Take good care of yourself.